Hello, everybody. I'm sorry. Hello, everybody. How are you? My name is Benny Rachmanov, CEO of iShook. I'm here with the great Mr. Tom Ellsworth. I hope I pronounced your name right.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So we're here to learn from you, understand your analytics. I love your show and PBD. And I don't think there's a need of an introduction, but your analytics and your greatness of the way you present ideas is fascinating to me. And that's why I wanted you for sure on iShook. And it's very important for us to see and visualize what you think in your point of view and perception. Because there's no doubt an individual with experience like you has all the success stories that we can learn from.
Oh, well, thank you very much for that. That's very, very nice of you. So it's really good to be here. Really appreciate the opportunity. It's just really, I think what's really interesting nowadays is the diversity of thought that's available thanks to all kinds of podcasts and iShook and everything that you're doing. It just brings voices everywhere. And I think that's what's so important.
I appreciate that very much. So I do definitely do. And we wanted to get your perspective specifically on AI, because AI happens to be the next, I think, revolution in how we define industry and commerce, besides the job force and the labor force. But my biggest concern is and how AI will be applied to military use. And I just want to present you, share my screen here, just for you to see an article from the Defense Department in regards to AI itself and what they are trying to do here. So if you see, U.S. endorses responsible AI measures for global militaries. And the question is, would this idea that the Defense Department apply, would this application even be necessary? Or will this be a potential hazard for military? I mean, because if you see what's going on with the war with Ukraine and Israel, the wars itself are defined very differently today. We never had in history social media coverage of wars that now we're going to have AI technology coverage. It's going to be, what do you think? What do you think could be the end game when it comes to this issue?
Well, there's a couple angles to look at here. And the first angle to look at is, you know, is AI in warfare. I mean, a long time ago, as certain things started happening, you know, way back when we had the Geneva Convention, which was sort of a set of standards and guidelines for treatment of prisoners and other things that we did during conventional warfare. And there were ethics that were built into the Geneva Convention. And now when you have AI, you have, well, first of all, I'll look at something that happened this week. And I'm not casting any guilt. We're just saying what happened. Right. Did Israel want a missile to hit a car caravan and to strike the vehicle containing people from World Bank that were allegedly on a humanitarian mission? Well, even Israel said, hey, that wasn't our target. So the argument that, you know, the military has intelligence right now to conduct things, you know, from afar, you know, there's mistakes that are made in warfare all the time. And, you know, it's terrible and it's unfortunate. And so now when you put AI into that mix, take a look at AI. So let's just talk about something that everyone can understand: self-driving cars. And we've had a couple different organizations, one Waymo and others. There was a self-driving car that had an accident in San Francisco, could not tell the difference between, could not understand a set of barriers and cones that were set up in a construction area. Nobody was hit, but it ran through barriers into wet cement. Okay, well, another vehicle, unfortunately, ran over a pedestrian, pinning a pedestrian. So there's things that are in the AI that is helping the car drive, and things like LIDAR. And LIDAR, which is separate from a good decision about what's there. The military is, you know, AI needs practice and it needs data sets. So you're finding that the military is probably is using AI right now with data sets that they need to acquire data sets in active combat. And so by definition, AI is only perfected on the battlefield, perfected by using it in its early form.
So essentially, AI needs to, missiles needs and to weapons. Learn. You got to send it to the field to learn war in order to define war. But then who takes the responsibility of the actions of AI? Because ultimately, when you judge a person or judge a military, it's based on the intent and then the action. So now here with AI, there's not necessarily ever going to be intent, because we can always blame it on the AI's mishandling of issues.
That's exactly right. So the AI, the guilty party will simply be the country and the military leadership.
Wow. So if that's the case, then in reality, what happens is that ultimately the AI, can you imagine an AI having a nuclear prompt? I mean, that could be itself a problematic issue. I mean,
that's a heavy question. That is a very, very heavy question. If you were to think about AI this way, is you can read any number of books that have been written by members of SEAL Team 6. And there's been transparency to the battlefield practices by the men who've served SEAL Team 6. With each shot and kill, they had with them an observer, and they were communicating about their assessment of the target before the kill shot was taken. And you could have been court-martialed or relieved of duty or sanctioned for taking a kill shot against an innocent civilian. So now if you take the actor, the member of SEAL Team 6, the human out of it, what if that's a robot powered by AI, a robotic soldier that takes that shot, and it is an innocent civilian? Now what?
Wow.
What if it's a, you know, we've seen pictures of the missiles fired from airplanes striking. You can see people fleeing structure and saying, oh, that was a known hideout or headquarters of a cell, a terrorist cell or a military cell. So how do you know that is, you know, to use a phrase in the United States, how do you know that's not PS-113? And if the military makes a mistake in the fog of war, there's never been citizens that were deceived by their own military who lied about what happened on the battlefield. That's never happened to Russian citizens, American right. citizens, British citizens, and yes, Israeli citizens, where the government said, yeah, we're not going to talk about this one. And then it comes up later and they're like, okay, how do we spin this? So in the fog of war, AI presents all sorts of things where the member of SEAL Team 6 can be censored for his actions. But what do you do with a robotic soldier? Who do you censure? How do you make corrective actions? Who's responsible? Right. The humanity, because the West is usually far more humane than its adversaries, if you look at most engagement.
All right, that's true. I mean, there's a new show from TV Plus that with the World War II, where they only used to bomb during the day. And in reality is that we lost more pilots in the bombings during the day than the Brits who did it at night when they bombed the German areas for liberation, I believe. But in reality is, but AI, the way I understand AI, it only matches the reality of the prompts and the predictive information that's given. So whatever Correct. Information is given to each government, you know, the fog of war might not even exist. What war might be considered to be 95%, AI might think that's the 100% of how war interacts, because there's no such Correct. Thing as 100% accurate warfare.
No, there's not. There is in conventional warfare. There's not 100% accuracy. Bombs are dropped on targets that were based on bad data, and so you know AI is going to take shots based on bad data.
So reality, AI is not, AI can cause more problems than we can imagine in the military world.
Well, yeah, and the ethics of it is: does the human wait a split second and then determine that there's the human assessment and the human feeling, and a a person with a moral compass who cares about, you know, civilians, even civilians that may not agree with your way of life. There is something to the humanness and the human spirit and the human heart that says, wait, I have a feeling about that. And that doesn't take shots. Pilots have talked about this. You know, they have confirmation of enemy aircraft. They have radar signatures. They have a lot of great data. And that airplane is shooting. Okay, that's pretty good indication. But when you're talking about ground targets and other things like this, that's where I think that they need the AI. They want the AI, but we're going to have, you know, the AI is going to make mistakes. Just like we're seeing self-driving cars are making mistakes. That's AI in action.
Right. Right. So AI, not necessarily. So can you imagine AI right now being applied to oil rigs? I mean, I don't see how that even is even possible, where the AI can determine safety and conditions of a situation with engineering and in working and in construction. I mean, just in that itself, I mean, if it can be applied to military, how do we apply it to anything else? Because I think that's the high to the low. Right. If you can't apply it to the most highest extreme, how can we even apply it to the most lowest extreme of safety issues?
I agree.
Wow. Awesome. Awesome. But do you think there's any other application in the future that AI could present in regards to military aspects? I mean, because what I understand now is being used.
I think there's a lot of applications. You know, I think AI to inform is tremendous.
Agreed.
AI to inform battlefield decisions and to do so faster. But leaving, you know, to the Western world, you know, leaving it to us to make the decisions about the shot, I think is important.
So basically AI should not pull the trigger. They just give us the data and we ultimately have to be pulling the trigger. Basically, there should not be a prompt, kill and shoot when you see A, B, C.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that are in the military to make this decision. I don't know if I'm ready to hear that AI is fighting a war and making a decision about congested civilian area targets.
Well, from what I've heard in my, you know, what I did research a little bit on this, I've heard that the drones that are being used to drop certain payloads are actually using AI to determine locale and determine precision bombing. That's what from what I understood. I mean, if they're already using it, I think it's too premature to use it. That's just what I'm coming out. And I'm glad that your assessment is obviously no doubt that we got to be weary of this AI application. I mean, no doubt the AI application for informational, for determining logics, to determining code, and creating code, I think that's where AI really should be placed on, not the military aspects. And I think that's where we should be more careful about AI in general, because I think that's where we might fall into the wrong hands, because AI is not as predictive as we think. It is biased. There are many reports that ChatGPT, it comes out to be more liberal as opposed to other other AIs, and there's with answers and responses. And it's all, and also when Bard became Genesis now, they try to do image AI, and that image AI started to change the actual depictions of history. So not only do we have problems with AI in regards to determining political points of views and presenting facts, they're actually also, the AI is not even there enough to determine historical depictions. You know, they're not able to determine facts when they create an image of a history. And I think that's in itself a problem. What do you think about that?
I agree with your assessment. You know, if AI is merely like battlefield applications, if AI is assessing approximations and feeding it back, potential threat and approximations, that's one thing. And I think a lot of that happens now with radar. You know, radar goes out and looks at things in aircraft and says, these signatures indicate, these particular signatures are very, very close, and we believe that might be a MiG. So let's focus on that and determining the threat of that. And now we've been given, you know, an AI assessment that this is likely a MiG. Well, now you can approach that threat on radar as a likely, as you know, and I think that's where it's going to be tremendously helpful.
Wow. Awesome. To the next point, regards to beyond Bitcoin and Ethereum. And I want to share a certain situation that we had with iShook. And this is part of entrepreneurial work, right? I just want to share this screen. There was an individual named Sam Lee that we met before COVID in China. We were supposed to meet him. We never met him at the end. He was a crypto billionaire. Yeah. And at the end, what ended up happening with Sam Lee, he was charged by the SEC for a $1.7 billion Ponzi scheme. So, and he lives in Dubai, and he took about 2 million of our tokens, right? And at the end, the SEC charged the founder of 1.7 Hyperfund, which was what the fund was called, just to show it again to the viewers. This was Hypertech. These were the players. Sam Lee was a crypto billionaire. He lived in Australia. He had like 30 exchanges. We thought it was in the up. We invested close to $30,000, sent him 2 million of our tokens. And at the end, it found out to be that he was in the scheme of Ponzi. If you see over here, investors is getting returned 3 times return in 600 days by only investing $3,500. And basically, the SEC sued them for this Ponzi scheme over here. Charges founder of $1.7 billion, Hyperfund crypto pyramid scheme, and top promoter with fraud. So now, what do you think that does to the blockchain community and the crypto community? Because we know there's thousands of alternate coins. I mean, these are coins besides of Bitcoin and obviously Ethereum. What? Because there are a lot of good applications with these altcoins, like Polygon and Polkadot and all these other companies that are really creating use cases that really help the communities grow and help blockchain grow in itself. So what do you think will be the future when it comes to that in itself?
So there's a couple things. So, you know, Ethereum really got, you know, I'm going to use a word here that some people are going to scream at because it was already legitimate. But there is a certain amount of additional legitimization for the average investor when Ethereum crossed over and basically being the currency of NFTs.
Right.
When that happened, now Ethereum was legitimate before. Let me say that. You know, I am a supporter, you know, and proponent and owner of Bitcoin and Ethereum. And at the time the NFTs came out, average people were like, wow, this is like buying artwork. And so they saw a simple example of that. And there was a major gold rush on NFTs. And so people said, well, maybe I'll be like a timeshare. I'll own a little bit of one of those apes that was so popular and say, great. Right. Or I own one of the less rare apes. So I own one ape for, well, you're one of the, you remember what, right, I'm talking about?
The one is like $120 million and it dropped completely like over 1,000% of value.
To nothing. Yeah. So you went out and did it. So there was a certain acceptance and additional legitimization into the mind of the common investor around NFTs, specifically apes. Things are so, gosh, there's so many people talking about this. There's so many threads. There's so much stuff on the internet. My goodness gracious, even my local news is talking about it. It must be okay because they don't go three levels down and think about it. And then of course you have Bitcoin being Bitcoin. So the question is, you know, is there a potential for some of these altcoins surpassing the success of Bitcoin? I don't know. We've talked about a lot of them. I mean, Elon Musk got behind Dogecoin, right?
Right.
So, you know, who knows? You know, it could be, you know, but it seems like Bitcoin had the benefit of this track record of up and down and up and down, almost like a stock, and it's still here, it still has value, and it's still got the blockchain attached to it. You can still have it in your wallet. There's still going to be a limited supply. Mining is very expensive and very rare. There's only going to be so many of them. So it's, right, you know what I mean? There's a certain amount of that that says, wow, how can, you know, is it possible an altcoin could have this sort of legitimacy? and success? It's possible. Do I think it's probable? No. I think Bitcoin's going to lead. Will there be some altcoins that have a percent of Bitcoin success? Well, yeah, but we've seen some of the altcoins that until they have like an event that makes them individually crash, they tend to follow the market.
Right. Right. They definitely do. They definitely do. But at the same time, the reason why I bring this question up is because now we know Bitcoin is actually losing. It's close to its cap. I think it's 21 million Bitcoins is the circulating cap. Right. And then what's happening is with Bitcoin itself, I think now you're getting about from 8 to 4 Bitcoins per machine per day mining. So eventually it's going to run out. I mean, and then you see BlackRock buying out Bitcoin, 220,000 types, 220,000 Bitcoins and constantly adding to their reservoir of Bitcoins. And then you have the EFT, right? I hope I'm saying it right. The EFTs are what they're doing, or ETF, right? EFTs are what they're doing with Bitcoin itself, where you can invest without actually owning Bitcoin. So ultimately, eventually, Bitcoin is not going to be for the layman. It's not going to be for the basic user. It's going to be for the rich folk. Those who have $200,000-$300,000 is going to end up becoming like a banking and a government utility, as opposed to a regular utility that you and I can use per se for, you know, small purchases.
Well, you know, that's kind of the way certain stocks are now. Not all the stock of a company is on the market. I mean, the enterprise value of companies is often larger than the market cap. So that the enterprise value of the company and the, yeah, I'll look up a couple now. I'm just curious. I'll look up Microsoft. You know, but I'd love so just because there's scarcity in the market will just make the price go up, right?
Right.
Okay. That's what I would think. That's usually typically what happens. So let's go take something like a Microsoft and let's see if we can find the enterprise value and the market cap, you know, because I think that's what we're talking about here, is that there'll be far more. Okay.
And I mean, because of the scarcity of Bitcoin, people would want eventually an alternative token. I mean, Ethereum will be the next one up and running, but Ethereum has no cap. Ethereum is constantly mined and constantly burnt.
Yeah, exactly. There's all sorts of things that, you know, we have to consider, but I don't know. All right.
I mean, if altcoins were not doing so well, you wouldn't have a platform like Uniswap, right? And all these DeFi platforms really making it, in a sense.
Yeah. You know, if it was just a swap, I suppose.
Right. Well, yeah, depends on the utility and the use of each token. What do you think? Will AI ever meet blockchain technology where we automate blockchain with AI? I mean, is that even possible? Would that ever meet? I mean, I'm thinking about that now when I'm hearing AI and blockchain. We're in both spaces with iShook. I mean, we have our own blockchain, we have our own AI, and we're creating, you know, we're creating a lot in the combination. And they're thinking, would that be the future? And is that even worth for individuals combining both technologies together?
Well, I think, you know, there's a couple ways to look at that. You know, is there going to be AI in the blockchain world? Well, there might be, but blockchain is not about, you know, artificial intelligence or approximations. It's not about, let me take that back. Blockchain is not about approximations. Blockchain is about knowing that a transaction or event existed and is forever memorialized, you know, and so that the modification of it is not possible, which is why they talk about voting, that if voting was on the blockchain, you know, let illegal aliens vote, but make sure everybody only has one vote in one jurisdiction. You voted in Georgia, you voted in New York, you voted in Pennsylvania, you voted in Texas.
So why is, you know, why, listen, that's a great point. Why are they not adopting voting systems with blockchain? Where each one gets a QR code You come in with your QR code, you get a download from the government site, you submit your information, and then you are able to vote. I mean, I know I met individuals in blockchain, what's it called, conferences, where they try to do this voting blockchain. And just, I never heard from them since, you know?
Yeah. You say you've never heard since, they haven't disappeared or something, but it's just, you haven't run into them again, but
well, yeah, that's possible. Or they never succeeded with governments to get it applied.
I mean, I'd love to see a small state with a controlled number of voters like a Delaware. You know, right. I suppose all states have a controlled number of voters, but you could do a blockchain voting in Delaware with a few million people rather easily, as opposed to with, you know, hell, pick Vermont, right. Pick the least populous state.
Right. Vermont. And then have them have it first locally, ran for local elections first. I think that would be the probable bet. Getting these blockchains run on local places, local districts, have those local districts do a voting system for municipalities, for, let's say, city council or whatever it is, and then run a test that way. I mean, I think blockchain and AI would eventually meet together.
That's it in Wyoming. There's 575,000 to 600,000 total population in Wyoming. That's it.
Wow. That's a great idea.
So you seems to me that you could run an experiment there on everybody who's 18 years old and, you know, voting via blockchain. And now you have voter turnout that's better. Everybody participates.
That's a great idea. I think Mr. Ellsworth, you got an idea over here. You know what I mean? I didn't even think of that. I mean, that's awesome. I mean, and then you probably use the AI tech to scan the voting and validate each vote. Ultimately, they have that technology with handwriting recognition. I mean, that's for sure there. That's for sure there. I want to get to the next topic, the boycott against Israel. I want to show you another article. I mean, I know everybody's trying to boycott Israel, and I don't want to get too much into the politics of Israel. But I want to understand, how is it even possible? Let me just share the screen again. How would it be possible to boycott Israel when most of the technologies and the technologies and most of the development of technology is from Israel? I mean, right now, McDonald's to reacquire franchise chains in Israel amid boycotts. I mean, we have maybe like 2-3 restaurants in McDonald's in Israel. But, you know, you don't see McDonald's or any other company buying out franchises or so on and so forth, let's say in Ukraine or other countries. I mean, the reality is that this boycott, how far can a boycott even get to in Israel? And are there any ramifications? If you really want to boycott Israel, then boycott all the tech, all the patents that Israel holds today.
Now, when you're talking about boycotts, boycotts are usually against companies and against products. And then countries are able to, boycott or block, you know, supply chains like oil. Very, you know, not hard to do. We cannot accept any tankers with oil from Venezuela, or you're can pay a fine. And then all the U.S. oil companies are like, okay, well, all right, I guess that's what we're doing. But boycotting a country, it's hard to boycott a country. It's easy to put economic sanctions against a country, but calls to boycott a country, you know, are difficult. And what McDonald's is doing is basically they're speaking up and saying, hey, this is what we're going to do. We're just going to buy back all of our franchise here. No need to worry about it. It's all company owned. And I think that what they're attempting to do is put a line between Israeli ownership and McDonald's. Wow. While preserving part-time jobs for many, many students and folks, 5,000 jobs, people in Israel that make a few dollars an hour working at McDonald's.
So at the end, it really does affect it. I mean, the result is that the boycott has worked. I mean, in a social structure, in a social sense, it does work.
Well, it did in the case of McDonald's.
Okay, that's a
good point. Will it work for every company? You know, I don't know. And, you know,
I mean, SodaStream, by the way, SodaStream, just a side point, I'm sorry for cutting you off, but SodaStream was forced to move its warehouse and factory from north of Israel and Samaria to mid Israel. And all those workers who were working there lost their jobs. And there weren't even Israelis who lost the jobs. It was actually Palestinians and other ethnic groups that lost their jobs because they couldn't have that factory there anymore.
Sure. You know, Jordanian expats, Lebanese expats that came over the border from, you know, not far away and, you know, lived in the townships up there and found a job.
Right. So ultimately, like, these boycotts are more or less like, it's like a sanction from the U.S. government to Russia. So ultimately, the social construct of our society creates these boycotts at McDonald's. I mean, honestly, I don't think Israel gets hurt by this because I think Israel was one of the first countries to establish a lab-grown chicken sandwich. And they serve it continuously in a restaurant. So it's the first lab-grown chicken produced restaurant. Basically, all the chickens and all the sandwiches you get are all lab-grown chickens. They're one of the first. It was a big thing in the news about a year ago before this war altogether. And it became a huge thing, this lab-grown meat, based on religious aspects. Is it kosher? Can you eat it with cheese? Can you eat it with meat? Does it follow the kosher guidelines? It was a huge debate and still is a huge debate in our culture right now. But I don't think ultimately... I mean, if there's a want to boycott Israel, I just don't see how it's going to, in the social construct, work it out. I know the governments are not going to boycott, but there are some governments potentially who might want to sanction Israel because of the war. I mean, what's your take on it? In reality, this is the first war ever that's been done via social media. Literally, like every minute of the war.
That the majority of the coverage is social media, right?
Yes.
There's not war correspondents, you know, your local BBC or Reuters or ABC, you know, right. Reporter and a cameraman with a helmet getting to the edge of the war zone to bring footage back. It's exactly. Largely been, you know, a social media war presented by citizens that are in the middle. And I think that's very sad because that means the war is being fought in civilian areas.
Yes. Yeah, that's for sure. But it's also sad.
I suppose soldiers, pure hot war zones, they're, you know, close to what's going on Instagram, I suppose. But
right, but we're also forgetting.
On October 7th, those were civilian areas. I mean, let's be honest about that.
Yeah, that's no doubt about it. But that's no doubt about it. But the reality is, the difference between, I believe, what happened October 7th and what's happening now, and again, I'm not taking away context. War is bad. No one likes war. I mean, that's for sure not. But the context is a bit different where you go through social media, you're not getting holistic information. You're always going to get snippets of information. So to put context into a snippet, it's not going to help us. And it's not going to help in war altogether. I mean, Julius Assange was is being indicted and has all this problem for leaking one video of massacres of civilians in Iraq, if I'm not mistaken, and other intelligence that was not supposed to be released. And now we have this constantly being, you know, put out with regards to the war in Israel and creating these social issues. I don't understand how these social issues will help any success story in stopping these the war in general. Or presenting any peace.
Well, I think it basically sensationalizes it one picture at a time to individual groups of citizens, you know, and all of it is going to be one picture in a point of time. That's the way war correspondence has always been.
Right.
Now it's just coming spontaneously and faster, you know, with commentary from the citizen journalists.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, what do you think in reality, will the U.S. dollar become, will there be no crash at the end of the game? I mean, getting back to this cryptocurrency, because I think the cryptocurrency in reality is funding many of these wars, especially with Russia, with other countries. They are using the cryptocurrency and the Bitcoin base in order to fund their transactions, in order to bypass the SWIFT transactions, and ultimately using this Bitcoin transaction protocols?
Yeah, so what is the question in there? Let's unpack it.
Is cash going to be the ultimate game? Because I know the government in the U.S. wants to abolish cash. China already has created a system you can't own cash. Israel, you cannot own more than 6,000 shekel in your house. There's been a huge undertaking within governments to literally defect cash as part of our process of payments in general. And is this something that ultimately will happen in the U.S.? Because with the USDC by Circle, and then you have, I know USDT with is not being accepted, right? The Tron protocol, US is really against it. And the USDC with Circle, and I think Kevin O'Leary owns it with Coinbase. I think there's a whole shtick going on there, which is the dollar-backed token. And now XRP has said they're holding up a lot of cash money to back up the tokens. And it seems to be that these big companies are literally creating a war within the finance industry to literally destroy the cash. Like, no one will have cash at the end. That's ultimately what I'm saying. And the idea is to use crypto. Wow.
You know, you're basically going to be, meaning the governments are going to control money supply, and they're going to control money in whatever form it is. But if it's a digital form, and you're not permitted to have certain amounts of it, then that's that. You know, cash available. That's a whole different discussion, along with people that believe there's conspiracies for the government to eliminate cash so that they can control it. And if you're all on digital, you're not on cash.
Right.
Did you freeze?
No, we were good. We're good. It's fine. It's the first episode with you in general. We're using a new platform called Restream. I'm plugging them. So it's okay. It's okay. I also want to ask, drop name Minect, right? I want you to talk about Minect, because that's how we got connected. I want to know how is it growing? Because I know there's many social media sites, and I think Minect, if I'm not mistaken, is like a influencer person connecting service, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, is that the main part of the platform?
Well, you can connect with influencers, but it's far more than that. It's any expert in your life. There could be an accountant in your same town who is an absolute expert on independent home builders, and you didn't even know that particular accountant existed. But he has a thriving practice, and he works with all the home builders in your area. And you find him on Minect, and you're able to connect with him and get expert advice that is exactly tailored to where you are and what you need in this life. I've had more Minects than anybody else on the platform. I'm coming up on 1,200 questions that I've answered. That's a combination of questions and video one-on-ones. And I will tell you, now I call them, that I've answered 20 questions for them on Minect. And it's simply, they are using me sort of as a shadowing consultant as they improve the state of their business. I'm the board member they didn't have. I'm the advisor that's not readily available. And I'm the confidant they have so that they can maybe run something by someone before they mention it to their management team, maybe spook people, or the members of their management team may have different personal motivations, you know, about a bonus or a position or political fight in their own company. And they're like, why can't I just have a conversation with somebody where I'm not speaking to my staff, and I'm not speaking to the board, that I can confidentially get feedback before I take the next step? Boom. And for those that are not business owners, maybe it's a very, very small business owner that's doing drop ships on Amazon. They don't have a team. They don't have investors. They don't have a board. They got a $300,000 a year business, and they have a couple questions about optimizing social media, and they'd like someone to give them feedback on it. So what Minect does is it brings together this huge, huge library of experts, and so that any user out there, wherever you are in the world, can get access to it right now. Also, When people turn to LinkedIn, people are paying $30 a month to have a LinkedIn account so that they can build this library of people that follow them. But did you know that well over 90% of LinkedIn messages go unanswered?
Oh, yeah, I know that.
You're paying $30 to be on this. And because there's so much spam, I mean, right. How many replacement college diploma inkjet cartridge refills or, you know, lead gen services does one man need? Right. And right. So often the biggest lie in all the world is, hey, I notice we know some of the same people, let's connect. And that's not what they want. They want to sell you something. As soon as you say yes to connect, they're trying to sell you something that you may not even need. And so they haven't really even done a proper customer segmentation. So LinkedIn has become spam in. There's, you know, welcome. There's nothing but spam in your inbox. You know, well, it's the link.
Well,
the
LinkedIn, well, LinkedIn has sales. LinkedIn has sales navigator.
We, you know what we have? We have a near 100% answer rate.
Oh, wow.
You want to ask somebody a question on Minect, we can't say 100%. It's not 100%, but we are closer to 100% than we are to 90%. And that is a testament to, hey, if someone's going to accept $10, $15, $20 for a question, guess what? They're going to answer it. And so there's the beauty of it. So LinkedIn, you know, is LinkedIn, and Minect is a wonderful marketplace where experts can be found by users that need a question for their life or their business with the confidence that for a couple dollars, there's over 90% chance they're going to get an answer.
Well, I signed up for Minect. No one approached me yet, but one day I hope they'll approach me. But what do you think is your success story? Because you have Minect as a macro success, right? And then you have the micro, which is you and every other individual. Why do you think people are approaching you per se than anyone else? Not to snub anyone else, God forbid. It's my obviously there's something that you're providing that they need, because there's something they're seeking for, right? And you're providing it. Like, yep. What are these type of questions you're getting that you're answering?
Hey, I'm not an MBA 3 years out of a Ivy League school.
Right.
I'm a business owner and an operator, just like so many of these people. I've built businesses. I've come inches from losing businesses. I've come inches from not making payroll. I've made payroll. I've figured out big problems in business. I've conquered things. I've raised venture capital. I've sold companies and I've grown companies, and I have all of the scars to prove it. So when people come to me, you know, maybe they've seen my case studies. Maybe they've seen my bio on LinkedIn. They see what I hope they see is an honest, forthright business operator like themselves who's been through the wars. And since I've climbed Everest and they're looking for a Sherpa to take them up Everest, what better Sherpa than someone that's been there? And I hope in the BizDoc, my persona, which was a nickname given to me by a colleague that I used on Twitter coming up on 20 years ago, you know, I hope that's what they see. And if you look at the reviews, they speak for themselves. They speak for themselves about how it's been able at an economic price, getting a great answer for them to apply it to their business and move forward. The reviews speak for themselves on how people have been able to be helped by me. But more importantly, the Minect platform made me available, and it's making so many others available. There are so many wonderful experts on Minect right now, from Patrick Bet-David to, you know, journalists like Chris Cuomo. You know, there are such a library of people on there, and it's growing every day, and people are reaching back out to their audiences on Instagram, where they get all these messages, and on LinkedIn, and saying, hey, if you really want to answer a question, find me on Minect, ask the question, set up the time to talk, and let's do it that way.
Well, definitely, I'm going to do that for our company. I mean, honestly, Mr. Ellsworth, I watched Patrick Bet-David podcast. You guys are the best. You're very intriguing. You bring points that are very important to be talked about from individuals who have the experience, right? Like, no offense to a few of these guys who are sitting on CNN and all these Fox Newses and Newsmaxes. I honestly don't feel like they're like that they're in the ground, you know, ground roots, actually doing the finance and the business and really understanding what AI is and cryptocurrency is. I mean, an individual who's business like-minded, right? You want to hear from them what they think in the business world, especially a person who's seasoned like you and has the experience, like you said, and the scars that you said in this financial war game, right? So in that sense, you know, it's obviously Mynect is something that I was looking for many years. I'm glad you guys are doing it. And I'm glad that we have, like, I would never have been able to get you on a podcast if not for Mynect, right? That's the reality. And who knows if I get discovered.
It's right. And we have, if you go to Mynect.com, you'll find the podcast arm of the business. We are connecting podcasters with guests, and we are sort of the greatest talent agency in the world. Suddenly, you know, in my opinion, we're the greatest talent agency in the world to find talent to present on your podcast. And so we have ask a question in text, get an answer in text, get an answer in video, get an answer in audio, or set up a one-on-one where we could talk like this. It says, or also arrange time to book a guest on your podcast. And so we feel that we're providing services that were needed. There's a gap in the marketplace, and we're filling that gap and more.
Definitely. Now, are there going to be any other future rollouts of features or different types of, I guess the keyword is features, right? Like, are there going to be new features or new updates to the app that make it more streamlined? Like, do we get to see your schedule? Because I know in Mynect, if I want to close a date with you to have a discussion, you have to also agree to it. And, you know, it's a whole, I think it's more of a process, and I'm pretty sure you guys are going to, you know, make it more seamless in the future.
We're improving Mynect every day, and come to things like our Sales Leadership Summit or our Vault, the Vault Conference, which is coming up in September in Palm Beach, Florida. Come check that out. We make big announcements at our events. Come to the Sales Leadership Summit or the Vault Conference, hear those big announcements, but we're also working on it every day.
That is awesome. Is there any good advice you can give entrepreneurs? And I'm going to give you a question. I know this is off topic, what we discussed. I had a problem. This was the biggest joke. We signed up for a company called NewChip, which was supposed to connect VCs with startups. And they created lectures, and they created a system, and they created an education. And it was about how to financially be fiscal, how to do your pitch deck. At the end, they went bankrupt for improperly financing. So an educational platform and a connecting platform for VCs end up getting bankrupt. That's the irony in it, right? And one thing is, I spoke to maybe 10 advisors and startups, right? And everyone gave me this new different type of understanding of how to put a pitch deck together. What is the best way to put a pitch deck together? In a simple, if you can, in simple, concise info.
Well, I have a seminar that I do for people about putting a pitch deck together, and I believe it can be done in 10 slides or less. There's a few secrets to it, you know, that I don't have enough time here to cover those, but find me on Mynect or find me through Beth David Consulting. I can take you through it. But it basically boils down to answering three questions. You know, why did you build what you build, and why is now the time to do it? What are you replacing, and what's the magic that you have to replace it? And how do you make money? And are you sure there's enough customers out there to make money in the future? Those are three sort of chapters in any good pitch deck. There's a lot of nuance that goes in there, but you should be able to do this in 10 or 11 slides, along with a clear and concise elevator pitch that accompanies it. And if you want to know more about how to do that, you know, you could book an hour with me or do something like that. And I'm not saying that as a hook to sell. I'm saying it as the reality is that no company, you know, deserves a 5-second solution, you know, as, oh, this will solve all your fundraising. The company needs to be heard. You know, why does the CEO dream what he dreams? Where did this come from? So that the pitch deck that gets put together is more than just a pitch deck. It is merely the script that the CEO sings from when he personally presents the company. Because I am against making pitch decks and just mailing them out to people and let them interpret it. No, they're to be entrepreneurs should be presenting their dreams and their companies. Wow. And the pitch deck is merely an accompanying narrative that helped the story come to life.
Oh, definitely. I'm going to book the hour. And I suggest every single entrepreneur that listens to this show books an hour with Mr. Tom Ellsworth, and they're only going to get benefits from it. Because I honestly believe in what you guys are doing, and I believe in your analytics. And of course, you have the experience, and you're very open and very straightforward. And that's very important in business. I always tell people subtleties, there's no time for it. Because time is a commodity you never get back. So I beseech everyone, whoever really wants to get with get the best experience, link up to Minect, get there, build it, and hopefully you'll only have a good report on it. So, Mr. Ellsworth, I think we're good. I think I appreciate your time. And if you have any last
thank you, message, Benny. It's been so much. So, you know, and for people that are, you know, focusing on this, you should be watching this program when Benny goes live, you know, Benny with one N, you know, and come learn everything there is to learn, because I really appreciate what you, the CEO of iShook, are doing.
Thank you so much, Mr. Ellsworth. Thank you.